Hi everybody, and welcome to our first episode of Net Gains, our podcast about paddle and operating paddle clubs by Paddle Stars UK. And today we're going to kickstart our first episode with one of the hottest topics that is buzzing in the UK paddle scene, and that is paddle tennis and its impact on urban planning. Any paddle operators that I sit down with will say that their biggest hurdle to building purpose-built paddle clubs is the UK planning process. So we thought for our first episode, it would be great to get our in-house town planner in, Mark Batchelor from 40 Planning. Welcome, Mark, and Hi. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I really want to just kickstart for those that don't know you. If you could share a little bit about your journey and your background.
Yep.
And what makes you our paddle expert?
Yeah, okay, fine. I mean, my road into planning started from when I was at school, went to St Dunstan's College in Catford. Loved geography. Human geography was my favourite thing. Loved sport. Went through uni and did geography and planning there, and then went into a career in planning after that. Spent the best part of 20 years working in private sector consultancy in London, and then the itch I always wanted to scratch was to set up on my own. So that's what I did. And the company name 40Y comes from my school's postcode, which was SE640Y, because there was a nice little narrative for me going back to that. So that's where the company came from. And then I do all sorts of work. It's housing, it's commercial, industrial, and of course, lots of paddle tennis for the last few years or so. It's been great. It's been really good.
And that's actually how I first met you.
Yeah.
It was planning to do with residential and commercial projects.
Actually. Yeah, exactly that.
So are you a sporty person yourself? Like, is sport an important part of your life?
Massive. Absolutely massive. Like, every day I'm reading about something or other to do with sport, whatever sport that is. Played a lot as a kid. Still try and play a bit now. I decided to take up rugby 20 years after having stopped playing rugby. It wasn't probably the best idea. It wasn't the best thing to do. But I do that. I coach rugby, watch a lot of football, take my two sons to football, go swimming and all sorts. So yeah, it's a massive thing. I've done running and marathons and stuff. So yeah, really big part of my life.
And have you tried paddle yet?
I have tried paddle. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's good fun. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's great fun.
Yeah.
But actually rolling out paddle clubs
yeah.
at times isn't so fun. And that's what we're going to be tackling today.
Yep.
So can you just share a little bit about how you got involved in the world of paddle and how many planning applications you run?
Yeah, I mean, it links back to you, doesn't it? We've known each other for a while, and you moved across the Paddle Stars and brought me in to advise on a couple of sites. Honestly, I hadn't played paddle before then. That was my first little insight into it, and played a couple of times since doing it. And probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 live applications, I suppose, dealing with various sites across the southeast, of various different sizes and formats and all the rest of it. So yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, we like to keep you busy.
Thank you. Yeah.
And in your opinion, why is the process like taking so long?
I mean, the process is slow with whatever development is you're proposing, whether it's housing, film studios, whether it's school extensions, paddle tennis clubs. It's a slow process. Planning just is. There aren't enough planners. There's a lot of development that goes on, from householder discharge conditions at the smaller scale of things to massive urban regeneration projects at the higher end. It's such a slow process. It's so bureaucratic. And just, you know, when I started my career 20 years ago, you could make a planning application really easily. It was quick and easy to, you know, to prepare some plans, get them submitted and have the council sign them off. And even the discharge conditions process after that was relatively easy and quick. Whereas these days, what you need to feed into a planning application, there's just so much in terms of technical reports, which we know from the paddle products we're working on, the number of reports that feed into it just takes so long. There's so much red tape to go through. And then when the application goes in, you know, councils have got, you know, so much work to do, and just planning teams are kind of on their knees. There aren't enough planners there. You know, planning teams used to be made up with quite a lot of sort of Australian and New Zealand planners who'd be here for a year and do a bit of work and would help support the public sector. That's all gone. And so now, yeah, it's like thin on the ground. And so there's only so many hours in a day for planners to get through stuff. And so once the applications hit the councils, they kind of stop. And then the planners have to go out to statutory consultees, whether it's Sport England or the Highways Authority or the ecologist, the tree officer, whoever it is, and wait for them. And they've got dozens of other applications to do. So you sit in this queue the whole time. And so you're told it should be an 8-week process, but the reality is it's months, months and months. Yeah.
And so I guess I'm right in understanding it doesn't matter that it's like an application for a sports facility. It just sits amongst everything else on a planner's desk. So whether that be houses or, like you said, like one person could be looking at an array of different types of planning applications.
Exactly that. You know, there's no priority given to paddle tennis because it's sport. There's no priority given to housing because there's such an urgent need for housing in the country. Everything just sits in the queue and the officers get to it when they get to it as part of that process. So, yeah, there's no priority given to paddle or anything else. It's just a question of time.
So without spilling the beans on any particular location, what would you say has been the most challenging paddle planning application you've dealt with today and why it's been such a tough one?
Yeah, okay. No, there's one that definitely stands out. And it's a site that we worked on where there was pre-application advice that was positive. It said that the facility that was proposed in the pre-app was too big. They said, look, I think it was 6 courts. You've got to make it smaller. So we went for a 4-court facility. The pre-app, other than that, was relatively straightforward. There wasn't too much coming back in terms of advice, in terms of technical issues or anything else that had to be addressed. So we thought, right, this is going to be a quick, easy process to get through. Application went in. And I kid you not, it's nearly a year now that application's been in. We're still waiting for a decision on it. It's insane.
Yeah.
And through the process, there have been various technical issues raised that, to me, just are completely irrelevant. You know, the site's next to a motorway on a sports facility without any housing anywhere near it. We've been asked to do a noise impact assessment. And I've said, who's affected by this in terms of noise? And I've never been given an answer to that question. They just say, oh, we need it. We want that report, and we won't even consider approving it unless we've got that report. So that's, you know, a few thousand pounds later, you've got a report. And of course it says there's no adverse noise impact. But that in itself just added about a month, 6 weeks or so to the process. And then there's ecology that comes up, and then there's something else and something else. And again, you're in a system where, you know, planning officers have a huge number of applications to get through other than just the paddle tennis facility we're proposing. And it's just, a year, and we're still not there yet.
So do you feel it's like almost a checkbox exercise that they just want to tick against everything, whether it's relevant or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is, again, the same across the board. There's often a lack of pragmatism, really, in planning. It's like, right, we've got to tick every box, like you say, rather than taking a kind of a common sense approach to an application, rather than saying, you know what, I can see that there isn't going to be an impact here. And I can, you know, as an officer, I can use my judgment to say there isn't going to be an impact here. So I'm not going to ask for that report. That just in that instance just didn't happen at all. And it's like, right, well, my validation checklist says I should have one. I haven't got one. So I'm going to ask for it, and I'm not going to progress until that report hits my inbox.
And it's so frustrating as an operator as well, because all you do is just see your costs stack up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, sometimes there just seems no reason behind it.
Yeah, 100%.
Which is obviously very frustrating.
So. Yeah, and it's funny because on the other side of it, you know, you can dig into the corporate strategy that the council's published and the health and wellbeing strategy the council's published that says, you know, there's elevated levels of obesity, there's insufficient access to sport, the objectives the council has is to increase and improve access to sport, to diversify the sports offer in authority areas. And so on the one hand, you've got the council saying, yes, please, we'd love to have some sports facilities developed here, and this is exactly what we want. And on the other hand, you've got the planning officer saying, but I haven't got all the technical reports that I need, even though they don't really need them. And it's, you know, again, I'm not just digging the councils out. That's not it at all. But they often work in silos,
yeah,
you know,
and there's not sort of departments.
Yeah, totally.
Probably sat in an open plan office, but not talking to each other.
And it's a shame, because if it was a bit more joined up, then perhaps it might go through a bit more effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't hide my feelings like pre-apps. I don't mince my words around it. I literally cannot see the point. I find them pretty vague. The advice they often give is non-binding. So as a town planner, why would you sometimes choose to recommend doing a pre-app?
it's an interesting one, and I have this conversation with my clients all the time. And I have some clients, but from a housing development perspective as well, for smaller scale housing schemes, where clients will say, particularly when they used to have the free go for a repeat application, they'd say, well, I'm not going to do a pre-app, which is non-binding. I'm going to submit my application for housing. I know I'm going to be pushing the boundaries too hard. It's going to get refused, but I get to submit
again
for free. And it takes the same amount of time, but I get a binding decision. And so they used to do that. I would always encourage those clients to do pre-application inquiries, because there is more to deal with in terms of design and technical aspects that is useful to discuss with the council and make sure you're aligned. For something like a paddle facility, unless there's a specific issue or challenge on a site, maybe it's in a conservation area, maybe it's next to a listed building, whatever it is, you know, there might be a reason to say, well, actually, there's some merit in having a conversation here with the council, because we can, you only get a chance to have a conversation with the planning officer and the conservation officer, for example, in a pre-app. Once an application gets submitted, that opportunity for a conversation kind of goes away. Mm-hmm. And so if you go into a pre-app with them, you get to have that conversation. But you're right, it's not binding. There's always the caveat at the end saying this isn't going to be binding on the council's future decision, which is fine, I understand it, but it means that people are and clients are less inclined to go through the cost and the time of that process. And in the context of a paddle facility, you know, they're often, you know, greenbelt sites, sports facility sites. We could submit a pre-app for a facility with a canopy, but what are we actually going to learn through that process that we can't already reach that conclusion ourselves? And, you know, as time passes, there's a catalogue of more and more decisions, more and more permissions for paddle facilities that have established benchmarks that you work towards. And you say to councils, well, this is how Council X has approached it, and they've given permission, and we apply the same logic to this site. And so, yeah, for paddle specifically, often I can understand the argument that there's no benefit in doing a pre-app for sure. Yeah.
And have you, so I say you probably did your first application for us, maybe it's been maybe around 18 months ago,
yeah,
probably, almost.
Yeah.
So have you noticed a big difference yourself as sort of the awareness around paddle has grown, like from when maybe you did your first application to, you know, we've just submitted some last month, haven't we?
Yeah. So, yeah.
And are you noticing sort of the difference, a bit of a difference now that there's more awareness around the sport?
It's an interesting question. It's not, I don't know that there's necessarily a difference in terms of the way the councils approach it, but what we're able to do more and more and more is layer into the planning statements all the examples of facilities that paddle stars have submitted through the planning process, all the permissions we've got, and use the conclusions from those. In a way, it helps the planning officer. It kind of, if you like, holds their hand through that process. So you can say, here's effectively the precedent for this.
Yeah.
This is how other councils have approached it, if it's a greenbelt site or if it's a conservation area, whatever it is. And so the body of evidence behind those applications is getting ever bigger, which I think and I hope makes the planning officer's life easier every single time to get through that process. So I do notice that the position the officers are taking seems to be increasingly positive in the conversations I'll have with them on the phone. There's, you know, they still have to wait for technical feedback to come, but they're more inclined to support it. Whereas the first couple, they're kind of scratching their heads a bit, wondering what this is and how they should be dealing with it. And there are a few other sort of planning permissions that I've referenced in the past, one in for Watford Football Club in the Greenbelt, an air dome, that's actually quite helpful just in terms of how officers should approach the challenges associated with sports development and infrastructure in the Greenbelt. And that's been quite helpful. But now we don't really need to rely on that anymore. We've got enough of our own evidence
to use. I suppose where we were putting the canopy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so say I was, you know, I wanted to put in a planning application for a paddle facility in the UK. What are sort of the big planning considerations? What would be your checklist to someone coming to you saying, this is what I want to do?
It's first of all, from my point of view, just understanding the site and, you know, is it a greenbelt site fundamentally? And if yes, then do you want a canopy? If they don't want a canopy, then actually it's relatively straightforward, because the council will say, well, it's outdoor sport in the greenbelt. That's what the greenbelt's there to do. That's a function of the greenbelt. So that's fine. And so it's an appropriate development, if you like. So that would be a bit easier, but most facilities need a canopy.
Not in the UK.
Yeah, we have rain. So yeah, you need the canopy, and that's the point at which it goes from being appropriate to inappropriate development. And that's when there's a bit more challenge, and there's more evidence that we need behind the application. So it's just understanding principally what it is they need, and then it's floodlighting and floodlighting impacts and noise and transport, and it's I would then advise on what those technical requirements are for the application.
BNG.
I mean, crikey, it's the bane of my life on virtually every application.
We were putting courts on courts, and we had to provide a BNG assessment.
It was unbelievable, wasn't it?
A hedgehog hotel.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, and doing one on a car park. It's like, well, there's nothing here. It's a car park. Why do we need it?
They just want
time and cost. It adds to it. It does add to it. So there is a shopping list of deliverables for every single application, and it depends on the specific nature of the facility.
Shopping list. Throw it all.
Yeah, I know. It is though, isn't it? Unfortunately, it's an expensive one. Yeah.
So what is sort of the government stance on paddle tennis, and is that filtering down to sort of local councils and local authorities at all?
So yeah, I mean, it's the government doesn't have a specific policy on paddle at all. The MPPF doesn't have a paragraph saying paddle tennis is fantastic and every council should be looking to support it wherever possible, but they do acknowledge the benefits of health, benefits to health, I should say, from sports development. And so the government's policy position is to encourage sports development, obviously, and paddle fits within that. So yeah, the government is supportive at a very high level. The macro level government is there to support these kind of applications. It's then for local authorities to apply that sort of the high level policy to the specific site circumstances wherever that facility has been proposed.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite, right now there's like this, obviously a housing policy has fallen in. Yeah. You would think there's obviously quite a lot of money in paddle right now.
It's
a marketplace that is booming and, there's plenty of work.
Yeah, totally.
you would think that there would be something sort of cited almost.
Yeah.
Because it would be a boost to the economy, right?
Yeah, so, no, quite right. I think where you do find it is through the agencies like Sport England, who would, assuming you're not losing other sports facilities by doing it, you're not losing a football pitch by putting a paddle tennis facility there. Sport England would normally be supportive of the application. That's the government agency who would advise on that sort of thing. So yeah, you would find Sport England being supportive of those applications, and obviously the LTA would be supportive of the applications. So so those bodies and agencies are very supportive. So it's starting to filter through.
Yeah. And how do you juggle sort of this need for green spaces whilst also sort of keeping up with the demand for new sports facilities?
It's a really interesting dynamic, and I use it, I come across it, I should say, quite a lot with work I do with schools as well and other sports clubs, where they don't need all of their playing fields to provide.
It's always the biggest argument.
It's always the biggest.
Open spaces, green spaces,
But often those spaces are private or semi-private spaces, and actually, if you can put a different type of sports facility there that is, accessible to the public, all of a sudden that, that privately owned space that people can look at and looks very nice but can't actually use it, suddenly it's accessible to the community and the community can come and use it. So those areas that have that kind of surplus land is there's the dynamic of the impact of the development in terms of loss of space but increased access to a facility. So there's a bit of a tug of war there.
And then when we're obviously submitting applications, or I'm sure like you've seen the headlines as well, I think the Times had an article recently about paddle clubs and gunshots ruining people's sleep.
I think
The Guardian wrote something about, I think, it some affluent town, and they all sort of came together to sort of ban this paddle club being built because they didn't want the noise on their doorstep.
Yep.
Be it that they would probably be the first people in the club should it be built.
Yep.
So there's obviously some strong opinions around like paddle clubs being built and common concerns in communities. So what kind of magic can we work to keep everyone happy?
Magic. It's attention to detail. Really, from a planning perspective, it's attention to detail. It's understanding the site. It's understanding the relationship with neighbours. And particularly if you know the area well from other project work, from my perspective, you know what the if like the mindset of the community is going to be, what their approach to development is, and then you know that you can have some early early engagement. You can talk to residents, you can talk to councillors, you can let them know what's coming and what, you know. Although we deal with it day in, day out, those communities will have heard of paddle tennis. They think, oh, that sounds like fun, but actually they don't understand it in the way that we do. So if you can have some of those early conversations, that can help. It's an education piece, really, effectively. That can help. And then it's just having accepting that not every single resident is going to support your application. That's just not going to happen. It's not realistic to expect that. You're going to find those people who live in the immediate vicinity of a facility, they're probably going to be concerned about noise impact and traffic. They're normally the two things that people worry about. And light spill at night time. Although with paddle, obviously with the lower floodlights, it's not so much of a problem. But if you can have very strong evidence in respect to those two or three things, then, you know, it sounds flippant, but even if they object, if the council's environmental health team doesn't object, then probably the planning officers are going to go with you and they'll be on side.
Yeah. It's just obviously not ideal. The bad press, you know, before you've even opened your door.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah. And, you know, then it's a question of trying to see the opportunity in that, I suppose, and say, well, actually, here are the other facilities that we've got that are working very well. Here's the community response to those facilities that's overwhelmingly positive. And actually, we understand the concerns, but this isn't the first time we've dealt with it. We've dealt with it, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 times before, and it works really well. So we understand the concerns. We hear your concerns, but actually, yeah, you don't need to be concerned. We know what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, we've also found, you know, sometimes it's like led from a parish council or, you know, like a small group in the neighbourhood. But the other thing is sort of enhanced drawing packs. Like if you do really high quality CGIs, because often if someone can see something and visualise it really, really well, it kind of, again, sort of helps with those initial concerns that they might have about, I don't know, their view being blocked across a big open space or something, you know?
Exactly that. And also, you know, again, paddle tennis, the sites that I've worked on, they're on existing sports facilities. Those facilities generate noise. If you live next to a sports facility, you live next to you know that when you move in, you know there's a rugby pitch there or a football pitch or hockey or tennis or whatever it is, you know, and with that comes an inevitability around noise impact and traffic and all the rest of it. And of course, a new paddle tennis facility adds to that and there's an additional layer on top, but you live next door to it, you're going to expect some kind of impact, a reasonable impact from that anyway.
Yeah. Do you, because you're so positive. Like,
you've got to be, so right?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite, it must get really, really challenging, you know, like dealing with like planners that are, you know, planners on the other side that are often quite slow and making requests that don't always make sense, or dealing with sort of neighbourhood concerns that, you know, sometimes when people are quite emotive, like the letters and whatever they might send in is probably not the easiest thing to read. Like, how do you stay so positive? Like,
I don't know. Maybe it's years of experience, I suppose. You can't take it personally. It's
because I'm not going to say what kind of language comes out of our like when you send us an email going, you'll never guess what they've asked for next.
Yeah. I can imagine. You can't take it personally. They're looking out for and trying to protect their own interests fundamentally. That's what they're trying to do. Some people don't necessarily approach it in the most constructive way in terms of third-party commentators. Planning officers, years of experience and understanding the pressures they're under internally. And that might be not necessarily from their manager and the impact their manager's having, but it might be political. It might be councillors on the phone. And the councillors on the phone because the residents are on the phone to the councillor. And so it's all cyclical, really. And years of experience, and you know, actually you can flip it around and say, well, actually, if you give them what they're asking for, even though it's not always reasonable, going back to that project I referenced a short while ago, you know, they didn't need a noise impact assessment, but actually it just gave the officer the ability to say, you know what, this has now been evidenced to be fine, even though yes, you could probably have reached that conclusion anyway. To have that technical report there, it kind of allows them to put a big tick in that box. Job done. I don't need to worry about this. And anyone who is potentially worried about that shouldn't be worried about it. So
they're actually, in effect, just worried about people coming to them and, you know, complaining.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, if it's coming from the environmental health officer and that officer doesn't have first-hand experience of paddle, rightly or wrongly, they might be on, you know, concerned there could be an impact. They don't know how far that sound will travel, for Ixa to use that example. So for them to have that technical report there, they then know they're not going to have local residents on the phone moaning about a statutory noise nuisance. They can say, oh, actually, yeah, fine, I can see this isn't going to be a problem. So I can see it from that side of things. Inevitably, it's a little bit frustrating when you have to go through that process.
Yeah. But
you have to try and, you've got to try and be calm and be positive.
And I mean, obviously, we have a particular strategy. We build our clubs in existing leisure facilities alongside existing sports facilities. But what other areas or sort of in the UK landscape, urban or suburban, you know, do you see opportunities for paddle clubs that might yet be untapped?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's loads of potential at schools, both from...
I work a lot with schools,
yeah. And whether it's independent sector or whether it's state sector, I think there's loads of potential there in terms of the size of a school and its grounds. I think the potential to introduce paddle there is huge. I think it could then, there's obviously commercial issues around it, but could that then form part of the curriculum where actually PE, some of it is paddle focused? I think there's opportunity there.
Yeah.
And then it gets people using the school. The school will get some income from it, which means they can enhance facilities elsewhere. So there's a cross-subsidy element to it, which I think could be really nice for schools. Other than that, you get so many empty like industrial units and sheds and buildings like that that you could repurpose really easily and just bring the courts in.
That's just change of class.
Change of use, exactly. And in those sorts of areas, or those sorts of sites, there's normally a lot of activity. So the noise issue goes away. There's no visual impact. A bit of highways impact, but there, you know, that would have had a use at some point, whether it's industrial or business or whatever it was. Actually, to put a facility there isn't really going to impact too many people. And so, yeah, there could be bags of potential around that sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess from the commercial point of view is that the rents are high.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's sort of... weighing up the two, but yeah, it will certainly cut down in planning.
You cut down planning. You don't need a canopy. It's so the setup cost will be less.
Well, then sometimes a head height.
Yeah, and then absolutely. Yeah.
And so what would you say is sort of your top tips for applicants to speed up the planning process and boost their chances of success?
I think it goes back to what I said a little while ago. Probably getting into the detail early. You know, if you're not, then there are going to be more and more questions that will be asked of you that will inevitably slow down that process. So if you can look at your site, and if you can see houses within a reasonable distance, just say, you know what, there's going to be a concern, or there could be a concern about noise impact. Let's not say should we or shouldn't we spend the £2,000 on the noise impact assessment. It sounds a bit flippant, I know, but actually spend that, get the noise impact assessment done, demonstrate straight away this is fine. And then if neighbour objections come in, the Environment Health Officer has got a report there that says this is all okay. It will just speed up that process. Otherwise, it's back and forth on that. Transport's always a big one. You know, get a transport consultant in, get them looking at parking. What's the parking capacity? How close are you to bus stops and train stations and town centres and all the rest of it? How are people going to be getting to the site? Because neighbours will be worried about that. They're worried about people parking on the road, parking across their driveways, all the usual sorts of objections you would get. Again, get into that detail early, understand that, know and understand how that site is going to operate. And once you've got that, you've got a really comprehensive, robust planning application you're going to be submitting to the council. It's going to make the planning officer's life easier. The technical officers, their lives are made a bit easier because what they need is there and in front of them. Their questions are already answered. They might have some follow-up questions, but it's quicker to get through that process. So yeah, get into the detail and... if you can, as part of the strategy, if you think it's necessary, early engagement with local residents or councillors, at least let them know this is coming. And then if there's a need to have that kind of informal conversation, that education piece, like, do that. Let them understand what this is. Invite them to go and see another facility. Come and see our, you know, whichever one it is. And so they get to experience it and understand it a bit better. That kind of thing will help the process.
Yeah. And I'm not going to hold you to it.
Oh, that's good.
But the last question, what do you see for the future of sort of, you know, the planning process for paddle in the UK? Do you see things getting smoother? Do you see, you know, a department just dealing solely with paddle applications? where do you see it possibly going?
I don't see a department dear. I'm sorry. Imagine that. Yeah.
There should be like just a department dealing with sports applications.
That would be good, wouldn't it? It would be good. I genuinely think the more we do it, the easier it will become, just because planning likes to pigeonhole stuff, and planners are good at dealing with things that they recognize and they understand. When a new concept turns up, that's when they sort of step back and just take their time massively on applications, because they don't want to get it wrong. They want to make sure they've thought of what the issues are, they understood the impact. So the more we do it, the faster the process should become. And it's paddle slightly unusual from that point of view, because other sports facilities, whether it's, cricket club development or something, they're fewer and further between. They don't happen all the time. Paddle's, from as far as I'm aware, fastest growing, and I can't think of another sport that could grow at the same speed.
But have you faced the same challenges, say, like with others, as we have encountered?
Yeah, but I have, but planning officers won't necessarily have dealt with it day in, day out.
Yeah.
So for them, although they will of course understand the issues, having that body of evidence and the number of applications there they've gone through and they've signed off, and they can see other councils have approved, and heaven forbid an appeal inspector signed off on it and said, yeah, that's actually okay, that will just help them get through that process. So I think over time there's going to be greater understanding of what paddle is and what the impacts are. There'll be more and more evidence there. I mean, we're seeing it already with the greenbelt stuff, where that was very, very slow to start with, whereas now officers are kind of getting their heads around it much more speedily than they used to be before. So I think, the pace will pick up. It's never going to be, here's the 8-week target date and they've achieved it, because I don't think that's necessarily realistic. But I do think it's that depth of knowledge and understanding of the applications will be there. And so you're not going to be, wading through treacle so much as you have been until now.
Yeah.
Positive, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, yeah. We'll end on that positive note. So thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much for everybody for tuning in today. And if you found this conversation insightful, we'll be having further episodes where we will be inviting on our investors, our CEO. So stay tuned and look out for future episodes. Thank you.